Great. Thanks, Indio, for the kind introduction. So let me tell you what I'm going to talk about today, which is this notion of convex graph invariants, and in particular, I'll talk a little bit about the applications. Everything that I'm going to say is joint work with Venkat Chandrasekhar and Alan Wilski. So Venkat was our joint student, and now he finished, and he's a postdoc currently at Berkeley, and he's going to be a faculty member at Caltech next year. So what this talk is about, and I'll kind of spend quite a while about motivating exactly what do we want to do in here. And many of you are familiar with the notion of invariants of graphs, right? So the idea is that whenever we have a graph, and pretty much I'm going to always be talking in this talk about undirected graphs. So typically we can specify those graphs or their properties in terms of invariants. And kind of some of the invariants that you may be familiar with or you're very familiar with are things like the degree distribution, the chromatic number, crossing number, the click number. There's all these kind of quantities that somehow they quantify some particular property of a graph that we may care about. Right? And there's a lot of kind of variety. There's, I think, a lot of different aspects, I think, of many of those, and they differ quite a lot, for instance, in terms of their computational content. Some of those are very easy to compute, some are very hard to compute, and they have all kinds of, you know, different properties about them. So what I want to try to motivate is why we would like to try to take some of these very classical notions of graph invariants and try to see to what extent we can combine them and marry them with convex optimization. And the way that I'm going to try to explain that is through three particular applications that we wanted to solve or you know, kind of we really want to understand. And somehow, at least, when we think about special cases of those applications, kind of the only way or the most efficient way that we know to try to deal with those problems have to do with convex optimization. So let me talk about the applications, and then we'll come back to the general definition. One of my applications, which I'll say a little bit more later, is this notion of graph deconvolution. So let me explain what the problem is in here. So the question is the following. Imagine that we have a graph, for instance, such as this one, right? So I have a particular graph which is given in this form. I don't have a labeling of the nodes. I just have a graph, you know, given in this particular way. And what I'm trying to do, somehow I have a promise or I know or I'm trying to decompose this graph into other graphs. Right, so for instance, imagine that I have this graph in here, and I have a promise, or I know that that graph can be written as a decomposition, as a sum, as just an overlapping, if you want, of a torus, in this case, and a cycle. Right, so the only thing that I have is this. I don't have any labeling, I don't have the nice coordinates of my torus, right, I just have a graph in there, and somehow what I want to do is to pull apart these two components. What's a cycle, and what's a torus? So what was our motivation? So really, there's a lot of problems for actual applications where you want to do things a little bit of that flavor, and that has to do a lot, for instance, with what is called this identification of network motifs. So the idea is that, you know, if you have a large network like a biological, like for instance, the representation of the signal pathways in biological systems, and what you want to try to understand is components, subgraphs, that perhaps you know exactly what they are, and you're really trying to find those ones. And again, there's a number of other applications where exactly kind of somehow what you want to do is kind of split apart these two components. And somehow in here, it's not quite obvious, you know, kind of how to go about it. If you were to design some kind of combinatorial algorithm, perhaps you will, somehow you don't want to also do something that's very specific to the case of cycles. But again, we're interested in these kind of problems where these kind of things can be quite different. And kind of as a motivation to why, for instance, we're interested in methods that have to do with convexity, is there's kind of a special case of this, which is some related work that we did earlier, that had to do, for instance, with the notion of if you have a fixed matrix and you want to try to decompose that matrix as a sum of something sparse and something low rank. And for that, or matrix completion problems, which are a little bit of the same kind. And for those kind of methods, somehow the best techniques that we know of, they're really based on convex optimization. I mean, there are some methods that are a little bit more iterative, and they use some other things, but they're very brittle. I mean, as soon as you start changing a little bit the assumptions of your problem, perhaps I don't care about exact sparsity, you want sparsity with additional properties or something, somehow they don't generalize nicely. But to the extent that you can do things with convex optimization, that's a fairly flexible formulation. And somehow, what we wanted to understand is, to what extent can we do something like this for a problem of this type? And by the end of the lecture, you know, kind of we'll try to understand at least a possible approach for this and the kind of things that we can prove about this. So the other one has to do really with one of the things that we were really trying to do is to get a better understanding of how to deal with graphs from a statistical viewpoint. So somehow in many applications we have, you know, kind of we're dealing with graphs which are somewhat similar, you know, somehow, I don't know, if you're interested, for instance, in analyzing a social network, or you're interested in analyzing, again, for instance, interaction between these different species in some biochemical system, then somehow, of course, you cannot talk about the specific graph, right? What you'll find is kind of slight variations of around the same kind of graph. And what one would like to have is a solid statistical theory to talk about, you know, what does it mean to have graphs that are nearby or graphs of the same family. And in particular, in here, we're not concerned, so again, that's kind of the motivation, but in here, for instance, we're not concerned with the issue, with the exact issue of how we put statistical models. We're not going to throw the probability aspect of it. But what we're interested, for instance, is in how would we do some notion of graph hypothesis testing, right? So I have a graph, and I want to decide, you know, does it look like this? And this may be, for instance, a family of cycles, or it may be, you know, kind of some well-understood graph family, or does it look more like a graph, like a grid in this case? Right, and what we would like to have is both a way of formally defining exactly what this question is. You know, kind of as I write it, of course, it's not a well-defined question, but also what we would like to have is some computational way of deciding, is this graph more like this, or is it more like this? And of course, remember that when I draw these pictures just like before, we don't have a labeling of the nodes, right? It's not that I actually know that my nodes are labeled in this way, and somehow I could just do something like counting how many overlap edges I have, which could be a bad way of doing it, but you know, kind of at least it would be possible. But in here, really, these graphs are mixed up, right? I don't have. And the other one has to do with notions of graph generation. Again, these are kind of idealized applications, stylized applications. There's many variations you can make, but imagine in here that you would like to produce a graph that has certain properties, right? I would like to more or less produce a graph, for instance, that the spectral distribution has certain properties, that with a certain degree constraint which is pre-specified. Perhaps I want some other, you know, kind of conditions on this graph. And as an example, a concrete example that you may have in mind, imagine that we would like to produce in some kind of automated way a graph that looks a little bit like expander, right? An expander graph is something that has a large spectral graph, a large spectral gap, may have a small degree, and somehow what we would like is to more or less just specify what properties we would like of a graph and perhaps produce some candidate examples of this. Right? So somehow in all these three applications, and again, think of them as trying to convey the meaning of why we need techniques for these kind of problems, but what they would really like is to have some kind of unified way of thinking about these kind of problems. I mean, we can, and we did to some extent, develop algorithms for each one of those ones, but what we're really interested is in the machinery, right? How can we go about understanding these kind of problems in a nicer way? As I said, really we're mostly for compatibility with previous work, and also to try to express, if you want, or to exploit the flexibility of convex optimization. We're really interested in putting convex optimization in there in the picture. So that kind of suggests this notion, which I'm going to define formally in just a few slides, this notion of convex graph invariants, which I'll define formally, but again, the idea is very simple. Somehow they're exactly the graph invariants which are convex. They're exactly the graph invariants which are going to be amenable to convex optimization, right? And I'll explain formally exactly what that means, because somehow there's a couple of details that one has to be careful. So what we'd like to understand is how to characterize them and represent them. What can we say about them? Is there any natural way of thinking about them? Perhaps are there distinguished ones? You know, what do we know? And I'll mention a few things perhaps. So I mentioned kind of a little bit about statistics, because in here we're not doing a probabilistic theory. Then somehow it's a little bit more appropriate to not talk about statistics, but talk about kind of the robust optimization picture of in there, and I'll just mention a few connections. I won't spend too much time on it. I'll mention computational issues, which are serious computational questions in there. And finally, I'll go back perhaps to my applications and try to describe what kind of these techniques give in that particular case. So as I said, what's an invariant? An invariant of a graph is really a quantitative property of a function of a graph, if you want. And the notion of invariant really means that it depends abstractly on the graph, right? I mean, it doesn't depend on the specific labeling of the nodes. Even though we typically would represent a graph, for instance, in terms of an adjacency matrix, then somehow what we want is a property that's truly a property of a graph, or if you want, that it's invariant under relabeling of the nodes, right? As I, we mentioned before, they're very useful in terms of trying to describe what a graph looks like. So if I got a graph, I can say, okay, this graph is connected, or this graph is bipartite, or this graph is not planar, and somehow that cuts down on which graph exactly I'm talking about, right? Or defined classes. As I said, somehow the reason why perhaps an interface with optimization is not obvious. Because when we think about where a graph invariant is really defined, then it's, as I said before, it's really defined on the abstract graph, on the graph itself, on the combinatorial object. It's not defined on the adjacency matrix of the graph. And typically when we think about convexity, we need a function that's defined on a linear space, right, on a vector space. And the set of graphs by itself is not a vector space. So somehow, like, you know, kind of what we have to, I mean, it's not very complicated, but we have to actually get away from this notion or try to do something about the notion that a graph can be represented by many adjacency matrices, right? There's many adjacency matrices that represent the same graph, essentially due to relabeling. As I said, we want convexity. Why do we want convexity? I mean, perhaps in some settings we can get away with convexity and put some tractable notion of if you want computationally tractable notion of some other class of functions, perhaps that we can define on graphs, like, you know, if you can use some kind of notion of discrete or submodularity, perhaps in some cases, but somehow at least with a view, as we're going to see later, for instance, with respect to spectral properties of a graph, to try to use things like convex functions or truly convex functions is quite appealing. And I'll mention a few more things about them. But this is really, if you want, the motivation for convexity. This is going to allow us to have global guarantees, and there are certain cases or quite often we're going to have efficient computational methods, and also brings in a lot of kind of simple geometric and appealing geometric interpretations. Right. So what's the notion or the formal definition, if you want, of a convex graph invariant? It's exactly, if you want, a function of that adjacency matrix of a graph, which is convex, and it's invariant under permutation or relabelings of the nodes, right? So it's a function in here of A. A is any adjacency matrix that represents my graph. And what I want somehow is this function to not depend on the specific labeling that I picked of my nodes, right? Okay, it's a simple definition. It's essentially it's a complex function that has to satisfy certain kind of invariance properties. And in this case, invariant properties are really just that it's invariant under permutations. Right? The same way that we define a convex function, if you want, or a convex graph invariant, we can define a convex set. Or an invariant convex set in the sense of this graph again, which kind of, it has the obvious definition that we want to say that the set C is going to be invariant if, again, if the set is invariant under permutations of the edges. Sorry, permutations of the labels of the nodes. Right? So, fairly natural definitions. So what are examples? I mean, somehow we can define things, but, you know, kind of... So it's not obvious, for instance, whether all the things that I talked about at the beginning, they have these properties. So certainly everything that's a graph invariant will have this property, right? But it won't necessarily correspond to a convex function. So what we want to try to understand is how those two things come together. So what are examples, for instance, of convex graph invariants? So whenever we have the, I mean, these are just some examples. If you look at the sum of the edge weights of a graph, let me perhaps also just make a point. So typically, whenever we talk about convex functions, we're thinking about the weighted graphs, right? I'm assuming that I'm putting weights on the edges. So in here, for instance, I could not talk about the sum of the number of edges, because that's a discrete valued function, right? And therefore it will never be convex. But essentially I have to think about putting weights on the edges, and what I'm really computing is a sum of the edge weights. And that gives me a function that's defined in all of the, all around. Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, in when I'm talking about a specific graph, it may be that all those weights are equal to one, right? It's exactly a matrix of ones and zeros. But when I think of the function itself that I'm defining, the function is really the sum of the edge weights, right? So it will be a convex function. So sum of the edge weights, maximum edge weight, that's certainly another case of a convex function. These are kind of quite interesting. So these are degree sequence invariants of a particular form. So what am I doing in there? I'm thinking about a graph. I look at essentially the sorted degrees of the nodes. And what I do is I compute the inner product of that vector with a vector with sorted entries. And if you do that, then that's essentially, again, a convex function. These are quite important, and we're going to see a little bit about those later. Spectral invariants. Right, whenever we have a graph, then you can actually compute or the genesis matrix of the graph if you want. You can compute the eigenvalues of it, that's essentially the spectrum of the graph, right? And then you can sort the eigenvalues, and once again you can do this kind of same type of operation. You put a monotone vector in there and you form a linear combination of those ones, and it turns out that this is actually a convex function. This is kind of well known, it's a convex function of a graph. The max cut value of a graph, when you have a graph and you think about what's a max cut value, so essentially the maximum overall possible cuts, because every cut gives me a linear function of the graph, right? The maximum of a finite or infinite number of linear functions will be a convex function, so therefore the max cut value is a convex function of that genesis matrix of a graph. Right. Chiar constant, so Chiar constant is essentially a normalized version of max cut, so you look at cuts and then you normalize by the size of the two edges, and it turns out that that's also, again, a convex function. So there's, yeah. Yes, exactly. So I have my graph. I think of the adjacency matrix of this. So the entries in here, if you want, you can associate A sub I j are the weights in here corresponding to it, to each edge. You may or may not have weights at the nodes. Let me call them A sub I. You can take those equal to zero. Most of the time we want to take those equal to zero. And then you think about a function in here of A that doesn't depend on the specific labeling of the nodes.
In particular, for example, all the top graphs of the graph would be valid because A equals zero, I mean AIJ equals zero, okay?
The subgraphs.
Yeah, because the edges, I guess, implicitly on the
But I'm not putting, if you want at this point, a compatibility condition between those. When you're saying you can delete edges, what do you mean?
Well, because the variables are essentially the weights.
Yeah.
There's one variable for each edge of the graph.
Right.
So that
variable could be equal to zero. Right. Yeah. But that would be like restricting a convex function to a subspace, and then it will exactly be convex. Right. Monique. If you want, I'm really thinking, even though in here I'm talking about a function, I'm really thinking of defining this, if you want, for matrices of all sizes. Right? So if you want, once you define something for a matrix, then you're automatically defining for all smaller matrices. And it actually inherits the properties of convexity, certainly, because you're restricting, and also the properties of... I mean, somehow you could define this for arbitrary large matrices or even for infinite matrices. But you know, if you want, if it's perhaps more concrete, let's just you know, think about these are matrices of fixed size, right, or graphs of... This property should hold for all A. Right. For all symmetric A, yeah. These are undirected graphs. For all symmetric, that's right. Yeah, so F is defined from the set of symmetric matrices to R. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's right. So they're exactly functions on symmetric matrices that are invariant in their permutations. Okay, so one of the points that we want to make is, some of the ones that I defined in here, they depend only on the spectrum of the graph. But that's not true in general, right? I mean, there's many of these ones. So for instance, we know that the max cat value, we cannot write it purely in terms of the spectrum of the graph. So somehow they're truly functions, again, of the adjacency matrix. So let me also mention, some of you are probably very familiar with this, but somehow this should remind you quite a bit, and it's inspired very much by kind of the kind of characterizations that one makes of what's called a convex spectral invariance. Right, so what's a spectral invariant or a convex spectral invariant? It's essentially a function that satisfies this, but not for all permutations, but for all unitary matrices, for all orthogonal matrices, right, in the real case. Right, so if in there, instead of having a group of permutations, we have the group of orthogonal matrices, then it's kind of well known, it's a famous theorem that goes all the way back to Davis and Friedland, that those essentially correspond to gauge functions of the eigenvalues, right, and von Neumann, I guess, also. But nevertheless, as I said, there's a big difference between the spectral case, or there's a difference between the spectral case and the general case of, or the specific case of permutations, but this is a fairly important class of invariants. I mean, everything that has to do only with the spectrum is quite important, because in particular, it has a lot nicer computational properties than things that have to do with permutations, and we'll mention this a little bit. But also the kind of things that you have in mind is that somehow spectral information is not rich enough to distinguish between isomorphic graphs, for instance, and there's well-known examples of cospectral graphs, which are graphs that have exactly the same spectrum, but they're actually different graphs. So somehow if we... spectral invariants, they're going to allow us to make and we're going to see actually later, for instance, in this convolution problem that I mentioned later. Also, the other point that I want to make clear is that somehow the difference between non-convex and convex invariants can be subtle, right? So, there's kind of well-known examples, particularly if you come from the semi-definite programming world, where for instance, that things like the exact formulation of which kind of invariants or which kind of properties of your matrix or your graph you're looking at, there can be quite subtle, right? So for instance, if you think about, let's imagine you have a graph and you look at the eigenvalues of a graph, so we're restricting ourselves to the case of spectral invariants, then there's a big difference, for instance, between something like the fifth eigenvalue of a graph, which is certainly an invariant of the graph, but it's not a convex one, versus something like the sum of the top five eigenvalues. So if you add the top five eigenvalues for slightly non-trivial reasons, then this is actually a convex function. But if you look at the fifth one alone, that's not a convex function. So somehow there's, again, the question of which ones are the ones that are convex is not completely trivial, and also, as I mentioned before, kind of the point that I made at the beginning, there's a kind of, because we're really talking about functions defined on Rn, or Rn square, if you want, there's kind of this difference between thinking about the exact versus weighted counting. We really always want to be working on the setup where we're really talking about the weighted counting, right? So for instance, and kind of we mentioned this before, it's a difference between counting the number of edges versus counting the sum of the edge weights, or for instance, if we were to count triangles, then it would be the difference, we would not really be counting triangles, but we would be counting the maximum of the triangle weight. Right. So again, that's kind of this difference that we always have to keep in mind. Okay, so there's a lot of interesting invariants that are convex. We're going to, I mentioned a few more are going to appear, but kind of what we're interested in here is to try to understand what's the structure of these invariants, right? What can we say? I mean, are any of these special in any kind of particular sense? Are there geometric interpretations? I mean, somehow, which ones are the ones that they have any kind of special properties in them? Can we compute them? Can we approximate them? Can they solve in particular? And again, that was really our motivation. How can we use these kind of techniques to actually solve some of the problems that I was mentioning at the beginning? So I guess to some things, I kind of already told you some of the answers. In terms of computation, we kind of expect that there's going to be trouble, at least if we talk about, in full generality. As I mentioned, things like max cat is certainly a convex invariant, and we know that we won't be able to compute that efficiently. So the other thing that you may also have in mind are things like graph isomorphism problem, right? Somehow, like, you know, kind of if I'm trying to compute functions that depend only on the graph abstractly, then somehow if I have many invariants are the same, essentially I should be able to do something about isomorphism. And of course, I won't in here. So we would expect some kind of problems in there. But we'll talk a little bit about that. So let me just say a few more words about the vector case. So perhaps there's a simpler setup, again, which is imagine that instead of thinking about functions of a matrix in here, I'm talking about functions of a vector, right? Just functions of Rn. And let's imagine that I would like to understand what are the convex functions of a vector which are invariant under permutations of the vector. Right? And this is a very, very classic, you know, kind of topic. Again, when we think about convex functions which are invariant under permutations of the coordinates, and those are so what we're trying to look is at a function from Rn to R which is convex and satisfies this invariance under permutation, right? And that's essentially what's called its intersection of the convex functions and the sure convex functions, right? So it's a very well characterized class. I mean, there's a lot of things that are known about this class of functions, and also there's a lot of connections with a whole bunch of other things which I kind of won't have time to mention, except one perhaps. So things like majorization, stochastic dominance, risk measures, order statistics, sonotopes, all of those ones, they kind of essentially combine different aspects of like what happens when you look at functions, convex functions which are invariant under permutations. So somehow some of many of these ones may extend, or we hope that they will extend, to the case of these more complicated functions, again, modulo the computational part. What's kind of interesting in there, for instance, is that there's a kind of well-understood geometry that has to do, and we're kind of going to essentially try to see the generalized version of this, to what happens whenever we look at this kind of invariance property of a vector, right? So when we look at a particular vector, y1, y2, y3, for instance, in this case in R3, and we look at all the permutations of this vector, which is essentially what we have in here, and we look at the convex hull of the set that those represent, and that's exactly this permutahedron, right? And what we're requiring in here, this property of convexity of a function, is essentially that it has, and this defines, if you want the other way of thinking about this, is that this defines an elementary domain, right? So we can think about partitioning Rn in there into cones, and each cone in there is an elementary domain that will correspond to, for instance, the specific ordering of my variables in there. So somehow a different way, or it's actually kind of geometrically the same, I guess, way of thinking about this, the case of these convex functions which are invariant under permutations, is we want to really define a convex function somehow only on the fundamental domain, but we want to make sure that it satisfies the compatibility properties corresponding to the different phases, right? In such a way that I can actually extend it to a convex function everywhere. Yes. Yeah. And actually, it's even worse than that, because what you have is okay. So what happens in here? So, or why do I mention, perhaps, you know, what happens in the vector case? Because in this case, we have a pretty good understanding, as I said before, of what's a set of all functions that have these properties. And we also know that somehow we only need, if we want to understand all the functions that are convex and invariant under permutations, somehow it's enough to understand a few basic ones. Somehow they all generated by a particular set that kind of in here essentially they would correspond to the facets of this polytope. And this motivates, if you want, the notion of what's called an elementary convex invariant. Right? So what's this? This is essentially a specific class of convex invariants that have a nice form. And let me kind of define them, and if you're familiar, for instance, with things like the quadratic assignment problem, you'll recognize this immediately, right? But in here, what we're going to define is a particular graph invariant which is going to be parametrized by a matrix P, right? So what are we doing here? We define this elementary graph invariant associated with the matrix P to be the following. It's essentially going to be the maximum over all permutations of the trace of P pi A pi transpose, right? So it's really the quadratic assignment problem associated with the matrices A and P. And it should be hopefully obvious that this is a convex graph invariant, right? Why? It's convex because it's a maximum of linear functions. For any permutation, this is a linear function, right? And also, again, by definition, this is invariant under permutations of the matrix A. Because if I put the permutation in there, then it gets absorbed into this one. Right? So this is a specific class of invariants that we can kind of understand easily, or at least, you know, we can write them down easily. And because why? Because they're parametrized just by a matrix. Right? It's not like some of the ones that I told you before that they have these complicated definitions. You know, max cut is a maximum over basis and that. Like, you know, the other one is in here, you just give me a matrix and that matrix defines an invariant. Right? And it turns out that these are really the building blocks for all the other invariants. Somehow what's happening is that these, we can think of the set, if you want, of all invariants, and these are really the facets. These are really the extreme points. Of the set of invariants, right? I'm going to write a theorem that formalizes exactly that. So again, what's happening here? I'm just defining an elementary graph invariant which is associated with a matrix, just parameterized by a matrix, and it has the following expression. And by construction, that's obviously convex and invariant. So there's a representation theorem, right? So there's a representation theorem that tells us exactly that. That every convex invariant, we can represent it in terms of these elementary invariants only. And the idea is that we can write, if you give me any convex invariant, any graph invariant F, then we can represent it essentially as a maximum of a family, possibly infinite family, of elementary graph invariants, and these are just constants. Right. So again, think about the way to think about this, if you want, is exactly the same way that you can say every convex function is exactly the maximum over a possibly infinite number of linear functions, right? And this is telling us exactly the same thing, if you want. That whenever we have any convex invariant, we can really think about, if you've never seen the picture, but you know, if you have a function, you can think about it as a maximum of a possibly infinite family of linear functions, and this is kind of exactly the same. It tells me that if we have a convex function, a convex graph invariant, then we can actually understand it as a maximum or a supremum, if you want, over this possibly infinite family of elementary graph invariants parameterized by this matrix P. Right? And somehow, again, it's not terribly surprising if you're familiar with other kinds of representation theorems, like convex functions, exactly the statement that I gave in there. Coherent risk measures, again, in the case of a kind of a statistical interpretation of these kind of things, will tell you that you can represent every coherent risk measure as kind of this supremum over different scenarios, and there's kind of a whole bunch of other representation theorems that will tell you you can write things in terms of some elementary objects. What do we know about the set case? There's a similar result, if you want, that both that essentially characterizes what are invariant convex sets, right? So recall that we defined an invariant convex set in terms of a convex set which is invariant, the convex set which is invariant under permutations of the rows and columns of the matrix A, and somehow we have again a convex or a representation of every set of that type in terms of this elementary graph invariant. Again, it's essentially the same theorem. And if you want a geometric picture, you should think about exactly the same thing, right? The way that we define a convex set in terms of all the half spaces whose intersection define a convex set, then this is exactly the same kind of statement. Okay, so what are some examples, some other perhaps, or a few more examples of these invariant convex sets? These are sets, these are not the functions, right? So for instance, things like if I look at the set of all graphs with a certain algebraic connectivity, right? If I were to define, okay, these are the convex sets, these are the graphs for which a second smallest eigenvalue of the Laplacian is bounded below by a certain number, that actually defines a certain convex set of graphs, right? We can put Gerth-like constraints if we insist that no k-cycle has a weight which is at least a certain number. That's, again, is a maximum of a finite number, in this case of linear inequalities. So you can just write it as a complex set. And there's all kinds of conditions of this type that you can also put. And this will all define, again, kind of nice sets of graphs. So you should think about this, for instance, in terms of the application that I was describing, right? How would I describe large families of graphs that I can later optimize over, right? So imagine that I could just write down which constraints I would like my graph to satisfy, and as long as those are convex or expressed in this way, then I can simply go ahead with it. This is perhaps, and in particular, we're going to use, I think, both of these ones in the examples later in the graph, the examples I'll describe later. So we can define sets, again, in terms of the degree sequence. We can say, for instance, I want my graph that have a degree sequence which is constrained in some particular way. And again, if I want to make this compatible with convexity, the only constraints that I'm going to be allowed to write are constraints that have to do with these monotone constraints, if you want, on degree distributions, right, exactly of the form that I was mentioned earlier. So if you want, if you're familiar with majorization, I mean, these are essentially majorization type constraints. What I would like is my degree sequence to be majorized by a particular vector, that it has to be, the geometric interpretation is my degree sequence will have to be on the convex, on a certain permutahedron, right, on the convex hull of a particular set of points. That's exactly what this is. And we can do exactly the same thing with the spectrum, right? And these are actually the kind of constraints that we're going to use later. So what's this connection that I kind of mentioned at the beginning, and I'm only, you know, going to outline briefly with robust optimization? The idea is really the following. So a big question for instance, in robust optimization, or in a kind of more deterministic approach, if you want to optimization, is how do you actually model your uncertainty, right? So very often, you know, you would just adopt some statistical model. But, you know, sometimes you can't rigorously justify exactly, you know, for instance, what class of distributions you're going to assume, or you know, kind of, there's a usual issues, if you want, that come whenever, you know, you're trying to model some kind of unknown phenomenon. So that's kind of an approach that somehow tries to combine a little bit the kind of things that somehow, the only thing that you want to do is you want to start from data, this is what I actually measure, and perhaps, you know, you put some assumptions on how risk-averse you're going to be. And the basic idea, if you want, again, I'm not going to go through details, but imagine that what I have is a set of data, a set of vectors in there, and I'm going to try to produce some set that somehow describes what would I expect if I keep sampling from that distribution. Then when you think about what kind of things you would expect then from such a procedure, then it's quite natural to try to put exchangeability assumptions on the data. That somehow whatever set I construct, I mean, regardless of what methodology I use, somehow it should not depend on the specific labeling of my samples, right? That I'm going to assume that my samples, somehow they, I mean, they're whatever they are, but the order in which I got them doesn't really carry any information that's actually going to help me, kind of define this set. And when you think about it geometrically, for instance, what that would mean is that somehow I'm not really concerned about describing, kind of the specific data that I want, but actually I really want to consider all possible permutations. So somehow a natural convex set to try to associate with that is exactly this convex hull of all possible permutations of the data. And I'm going to explain what happens in the graph case later. And somehow, again, because you want to allow for uncertainty, it's not that you only want to consider that convex hull, but also perhaps you want to allow for scaled versions in there. And scaled versions in a particular sense, it has to be compatible with the statistical setting, and the way that that's quantified is by what's called a risk measure, which essentially would correspond to putting some natural constraints on the coefficients, lambda sub I, which would you form that convex combination. So again, think about the way that we form a convex combination as a probability distribution, right? The sum of the lambda sub I's, x sub I's, think of that as actually a probability distribution, and then we can put conditions on that probability distribution, and what actually gives us is a whole family of convex sets that sit from the convex hull of your data to, you know, something that's a single point, just the average, and something that's possibly bigger. Again, it's a little bit technical. I don't want to go into the details, but there's a single point that I want to make in here, which is the following. That somehow if I have an object, imagine that I have a graph, or I have a family of graphs, then the natural convex set to try to associate to that is really to not think about that graph by itself, because the labeling is uncertain, but actually to think about all the possible about the convex hull of all possible permutations of those ones. So in particular, for instance, if I have, and we're going to use this later, I guess I have it in here, so let's imagine that I have a graph G, right, so G is given, and I want to try to define what's the most that I can say about that particular graph, then a very natural set to try to consider, and we can justify it from different viewpoints, is to really think about this set of matrices, right? The convex hull of all the permutations of this set, right? So A is my given matrix, my given graph, and now think about building a convex set, which is essentially the convex hull of all permutations of that graph, right? And why is this a natural set? Because when you think about trying to put those things together, convexity on the one hand, and the fact that whenever you give me a graph, I don't actually know the labeling, then somehow all the information that I have is really that I'm somewhere in there, right? Or perhaps, if you want, that I'm in one of the corners of this picture, but, you know, kind of I don't know in which one, so I'll just take kind of a convex one. And again, we'll see exactly how that happens. And it turns out, because, I mean, this is obvious from what I said before, because this is an invariant set and it's convex, it will have a representation in terms of elementary graph invariants. Okay, I kind of made this point before that somehow, because this is very related to isomorphism, somehow there should be computational difficulties, we kind of expect this. But it's actually worse. I mean, there's somehow, like, you know, kind of in here, this is about isomorphism. We don't really know the complexity of isomorphism, but we do know the complexity of things like Max-Cut or the quadratic assignment problem. So in full generality, computing even the elementary invariants, right, it can be complicated, and it's complicated. That's, for instance, for the case of a cycle, when P is a cycle, then this is essentially Chinese salesman. So, I mean, just the fact that something is convex, I guess, you know, most people know this already, but, you know, kind of, just because something is convex doesn't immediately mean that it's going to be easy computationally, although there's been a lot of work in the past, you know, 20 years or more, you know, kind of, that will allow us to understand how to approximate these kind of problems. So let me just say a few things, because we're going to use this in the applications. As I mentioned, very often, or at least a nice way of relaxing some of these conditions, is instead of considering this maximization over permutations, right? Permutations make the problem difficult, so we can think about enlarging the set to, for instance, the orthogonal matrices. And in which case what we have is exactly this spectral invariance. I think an interesting question, we haven't really explored this in some detail, is, I mean, somehow going from permutations to all the way to the orthogonal group, you know, kind of you make it simple. I mean, you make it very simple, because now it depends only on the spectrum. But the question is, or I think it could be interesting to see whether, you know, if you don't relax all the way to the orthogonal group, but perhaps some intermediate group in there, I mean, can you still compute some of those things? And we don't really, we haven't really explored that, but I think it would be very interesting. So how do we go about this, if you want to actually compute invariants, right? So there are several, or there's different options. So let's say that in here that you're interested in computing the elementary ones, then you could restrict to easy matrices P, right? So remember, these elementary invariants were parametrized by a matrix P. So perhaps one can restrict it to matrices of small support. So if P is small, so imagine that P is a single edge, then what you're really computing is a maximum edge weight. If P is a triangle, then what you're computing is kind of a sum over triangles. So essentially, when P is small, you can actually compute the things. If P has small tree width, like, you know, kind of, that's also another case where you can do some things. The case of symmetry is also interesting. I mean, there's been a lot of nice work in trying to understand how to approximate or how to relax things like traveling salesman or quadratic assignment, whenever one of both of the matrices, they have large symmetry groups, and certainly that's something that you can build on in here. But there's a lot of work, as I mentioned earlier, and some of this we're going to try to use in terms of how to approximate or relax this quadratic assignment problem. Okay, let me ignore about this. And let me describe, perhaps in the few minutes I have remaining, the kind of things that we did for our application. Right, so remember the problem that motivated us. The kind of, everything that I talked about, if you want, is really to try to understand the structure of the things that you're going to use. So the application that I was concerned about in here is this, the convolution problem. And again, let me remind you, the idea is we have this, we don't have this, we're given this, and we're trying to understand in there, you know, which part, which ones of my edges, if you want, correspond to the torus, which one of my edges corresponds to the cycle. Right, and things are not labeled, so I don't know exactly what they are. So what can I do? So essentially what I can try to do is a little bit like the kind of things that one does, again, in the matrix case, where you think, okay, I have this object, and I'm really going to try to decompose it as a sum of something that's in here and something that's in here, or something in this class and something in this class. Then what do I know about this? Essentially, I know that it's a, for instance, let's say in here, what do I know about this? I know that it's a cycle, right? But I know that the graph is a cycle. But about the adjacency matrix of it, really the only thing that I can say is that that matrix is in the convex hull of all possible cycles. Right? So again, the point in here is what I have, if I'm trying to understand, think about the adjacency matrices, right? If I were to write this as a problem in the adjacency matrices, I would write, I certainly have the adjacency matrix of my graph, and I will try to write A equals B plus C. Right. And this one I know, because I know exactly what this graph is, I'm given this graph, and I can just write the adjacency matrix. And now what I'm trying to do is to try to write adjacency matrices for this and for this. But I don't know what those are. The only thing that I know about this is that this is a cycle, the only thing that I know about this is that this is a torus. Right. And I cannot write down, if I were to try to write down some convex constraint on this, somehow the only thing that I could do, if you think about it, is that I don't know whether it's this cycle or this cycle or this cycle or this cycle, which are all permutations, if you want, of the same one. So the best convex set that I could possibly write is just a convex hull of those ones. Right. And similarly, I can do exactly the same thing in here. I could try to write down the convex hull of all possible tori. Right. What's the problem? Or what could be the problem? I mean, somehow those would exactly correspond to, you know, kind of convex invariant sets. But in general, describing that convex hull may be tricky if we want to describe it exactly. So what we're going to do, we're trying to use simple spectral invariants that we can actually compute to define those graphs. And in this particular case, for instance, what we did is we couldn't use just spectral invariants because that doesn't work. If you try to use only spectral invariants, it won't work. So what we have to do is something like this, or what we did is something like this. We put conditions in here that would say that the entries of these matrices, right, the entries of B and C, are between 0 and 1. So these are essentially the conditions that those are adjacency matrices. And we put on top of that the spectral conditions. And because we know exactly the spectrum of a cycle, and we know exactly what the spectrum of a torus is, we can compute the convex hull of the permutations of those ones and write exactly a condition on the spectrum. So these are somewhat non-trivial, I mean, to write explicitly, but the point is, if you have, you can write a semi-definite description for the set of matrices whose spectrum is inside a particular permutahedron, which is exactly what would happen in this particular case. So again, there are some conditions, I think I'm detailing them in a second more clearly, but you can write some convex conditions on this, some convex condition of this, and we can just try to solve this. And it turns out, for instance, and I'll mention some of the examples in a second, and I'll mention a theorem in a second, that for instance, when you try this for graphs of this type with random permutations, then most of the time this works. And we can actually quantify, at least in certain cases, what does it mean. And again, this is very reminiscent of the kind of things that happen in the sparse and log rank case. Again, I don't know if you're familiar with those results, but essentially what we have proven and people have proven in that case is that if you form a matrix by considering the sum of a sparse matrix and something that's log rank, then it turns out that purely from A, you can actually recover these components by doing exactly this kind of convex optimization. And somehow this is an extension of all this stuff to the case of graphs. So in here, this is exactly what they're doing, I guess, you know, kind of if we have A, which is the sum of these two things, what they're going to try to do is to solve the minimization of the norm of A minus the sum of the parts, subject to the constraints that we described before, like the spectral constraints and these constraints on the matrix being 0, 1. And from the geometry, we can understand a little bit about the conditions for exact recovery. There's a nice geometric condition that has to do with the intersection of the tangent cones of these convex bodies. So essentially what we have in here is whenever you try to express something as a sum of elements in two convex sets, there's the optimality condition is given by an overlapping or an intersection of the tangent cones, and if that intersection condition holds, then you know that you want to recover the exact property. So somehow the question in here is to really try to understand when this condition holds based on properties of the graph. And for instance, some of the kind of things that we, let me flash briefly the kind of conditions that you can prove in this case, and we need this kind of notion of what's called spectral comonotonicity of two matrices. So this is a very nice condition that goes again back all the way to von Neumann, that says that if you have two matrices, A and B, these are symmetric matrices, and they're going to be spectrally comonotone if you can find an orthogonal U that simultaneously diagonalizes them and the entries are sorted in both. So it's kind of, it's more than simultaneous diagonalization, right? You want to simultaneously diagonalize, but you also want the entries of both matrices to be sorted, right? So it's a non-trivial, it's a strong condition if you want on the matrices A and B, and again, it can be expressed in terms as a semi-definite program. So in the particular case, what we were doing, once again, is to try to solve this, the convolution, notation changed a little bit, but in here I'm trying to decompose A as a sum of these two. So, and the conditions that we were putting is the intersection on the one hand of the box, the matrices with 0, 1 entries, and this spectral invariance. And the kind of conditions that we can show for that will guarantee that you can actually decompose these matrices, they have to do with spectral comonotonicity. So essentially what we would need is to find, or the conditions are going to be satisfied, is there's two matrices, B1 and B2, that are spectrally comonotone, and they satisfy some kind of interlacing condition between between these matrices and the spectrum of A. So essentially what we have to have is two matrices A. One has to be greater than the other one, depending on exactly where the spectrum of, depending on where the edges of one matrix and the other ones. So the idea is the following. I'm kind of making a mess of this. But imagine I have my two graphs, right? So my graph, one is going to contain edges where the other one doesn't, and vice versa, right? So the idea is in here, A may have ones where or G1 may have ones, A1 may have ones, whereas A2 doesn't, and vice versa. And essentially what I want is that these matrices B1 and B2, they have to be positive or negative in the places or in the edges of a graph or in the edges of the other graph. And the point is, one of the things that we're, and really this comes from this tangent cone condition. And what they're really trying to do is to relate this with the statistics of it, right? With essentially what kind of conditions the spectrum of our matrices will have to satisfy, the spectrums of A and B will have to satisfy for these kind of things to be true. I don't have here, oh shoot. Okay, I'm missing a slide. But what I wanted to describe perhaps is, I have a table of examples, if you want, of what happens in here, the kind of graphs where we try this. And the basic idea is really that the kind of conditions or you know, what we can extract from that theorem, if you want, is the kind of conditions that you would like on these graphs that actually make possible separation. And essentially it boils down when you interpret those conditions in the appropriate way. So what's important in here, the kind of conditions on these graphs that actually make easy to distinguish these graphs, it's very interesting because they have to do with how many distinct eigenvalues your graph has. So if we have graphs in here that have very, for instance, the kind of examples that you were looking at are kind of these distance transitive graphs where you have a relatively small number of distinct eigenvalues. So essentially, we have a whole bunch of eigenvalues which take a value, a whole other bunch of eigenvalues that take some other. There's only three distinct eigenvalues, for instance, or there's only five distinct eigenvalues. And what that creates is that the convex bodies that describe these permutations, they're very pointy. Right? Whenever you have a graph of this, think about the permutahedron, right? Whenever you have a permutahedron with many entries which, that are the same, the permutahedron is very pointy, right? Because it's very degenerate at the vertices. Then what that causes is the tangent cones to actually be very wide. And when you think about the kind of condition that we have in here that had to do with the intersection of these tangent cones, then wide cones, pointy, you know, kind of pointy cones, are pointy convex bodies, are actually very good. So essentially, what that theorem will tell us is that whenever we're trying to separate graphs, it's very, very useful if these corresponding graphs have a very small number of distinct eigenvalues. And again, we can quantify them. I should really wrap up. So let me just say, okay, I was going to describe something about the other two applications. So essentially, this is, for instance, about this application of generating graphs according to certain, we want the graphs to have certain properties, and it's pretty much what one would expect, right? I mean, we can put conditions on, I would like a graph to have this property, so for instance, I would have my graph to be sparse, I would write my spectrum, I would like the second eigenvalue of the Laplacian to be greater than something, and then essentially what you can do is now you have a convex set of graphs, and what you can perhaps try to do, again, in here as a heuristic, so you would try to prove, or you would try to get an extreme point of this set. Right, and you can do this just by optimizing some linear function. It turns out that when you do that, for instance, in this case, you actually get exactly a graph with the properties that you want. And the reason why this is perhaps not immediate, or one couldn't expect this immediately to happen, is because typically we cannot exactly describe the convex hull in here. Right, it's exactly like the same situation, and same in the case of user relaxation. Okay, let me just say, this is my second to last slide. It has to do with algorithms, right? So this is a little bit kind of tricky. I think it's very natural from the optimization viewpoint and from the, you know, how would one approach these problems. I think in particular, the kind of applications that we have in there, I think the fact that you can actually deconvolve these graphs is extremely interesting. But very much like in the matrix case, I mean, I think there's a big difference between somehow the conditions that you can, or the methods that you can use to solve relatively small problems, where, for instance, in the matrix case, we know that we can minimize this convex combination of the L1 and the nuclear norm, right? And in here, we're essentially replacing this by all these convex invariants. But somehow, if you really want to solve problems of this type, which are, you know, of non-trivial scale, then, you know, you really have to go into the numerics of it, right? You cannot just afford to do in here a simple interior point methods when you have large matrices. I think a very good question is to what extent, you know, we can do the same kind of things in here for at least some of these invariants. I mean, of course, describing this in general is very difficult. I mean, there's a lot of work that people have been trying to do in terms of characterizing, for instance, the ones corresponding to quadratic assignment problem. But even for the case, I think the specific case of this combination of just constraints on the entries of the matrix, and simultaneously with that, we want to use spectral invariants. I think having good numerical methods to deal with those kind of things at the same time would be quite interesting. And what's kind of perhaps quite challenging is that even the vector case can be very difficult. I mean, when you try to do for large things this kind of optimization over not just a single permutahedron, right, that you can use Hungarian method or things like this, but you start having intersections of many of those ones, then it becomes quite tricky. And I think, what are good and sound numerical ways to solve problems of this type when they're large scale, I think it's quite interesting. As I mentioned before, I think further down the road, we would like to combine this with a solid statistical perspective. And how do you actually do this with actual probabilities in there? And just to recap, I guess, what's the point of what at least I tried to convey in here? There's a very principled way of thinking about, how do we deal with problems of this type? If we really think about how would we approach these problems on graphs or to what extent we can marry, if you want, convex optimization with questions on graphs. What's the largest set of, you know, convex functions that we can try to compute or try to characterize in the case of graphs? They seem to be surprisingly powerful in a sense, because, you know, even though we would think, okay, it's not really the natural setting, and to some extent it's not, you know, to put graphs and convexity together. But the point is that the fact that you can do problems like these separation problems, that from the combinatorial viewpoint, they're actually quite difficult. Because it's not obvious at all, like, you know, kind of, even if you were to design an algorithm for a specific case, like, you know, what happens if you replace a cycle with, like, you know, a tree? Or if you were to, like, you know, so one of the kind of questions, for instance, that we're looking here is if you want to decompose a, like, you know, kind of a graph as a sum of a tree, a cycle, and something else. And there's very good reasons to actually do this from the algorithmic viewpoint. I mean, because once you have such a decomposition, then you can do essentially a whole problem like statistical inference much more efficiently once you know that it's, for instance, a sum of small number of trees or questions of this type. So at the beginning, one would think, okay, perhaps, you know, kind of, it's not terribly obvious how much convexity will buy you. And in particular, I think what we were quite surprised is that the fact that those invariants, that somehow they're kind of coarse. I mean, when you think about just the combination of constraints on the entries plus constraints on the eigenvalues, right? Because that's really what we're doing. We're putting these constraints on the one hand on what the eigenvalues of this matrix can be and what the entries of this matrix can be. And apparently that seems to be rich enough, even though it certainly doesn't completely classify, like, you know, this, to be able to solve this kind of a convolutional separation problems. So I think, again, at least for us, like, you know, kind of, this is, I think, only scratching the surface, I think, of what we can do in this case. If you're interested, like, you know, that's a paper, and like, you know, hopefully there will be more stuff coming. Thank you for your attention.